context of the many worlds interpretation. And I was outlining this approach due to David Wallace, inspired by earlier ideas of David Deutsch, about how to essentially derive the Born rule within the context of the many worlds approach. So there's a bunch of decision theoretic axioms. I didn't give you those, but I just hinted at what kinds of things they were. These decision theoretic axioms are sort of older things. They're in the literature, and they have nothing to do with quantum theory. So there's a book by Savage called The Foundations of Statistics that has these axioms in. So you have these axioms, and you end up with a representation theorem. And I sort of hinted at that yesterday, and the basic upshot of this representation theorem, I'm not going to go into any details, is that a rational agent must behave as if he ascribes probability to each event or each outcome. Yeah, I mean, there's actually a bit more to it than that. There exists a function, which behaves like a probability distribution, and it has certain properties. The upshot is that a rational agent has to behave, if he's trying to sort of maximize his gains, then which is a rational thing to do apparently, then he must behave as if he ascribes probabilities. These are really subjective probabilities. A different agent may ascribe different probabilities, but they have to satisfy the axioms of probability. So this really just tells you, if you're making decisions and you're obeying certain axioms that seem very reasonable, then you better ascribe probabilities and you better behave as if you ascribe probabilities, and those probabilities should be satisfy the usual axioms of probability, like that they sum to one. So that's old work in Foundations of Statistics. But then we still have the problem, in the many worlds approach, we're trying to say that these probabilities these subjective probabilities should end up being associated with the objective probabilities that we get from alpha squared. So the argument there is, in quantum theory, the probabilities seem to be objective. So if you have a lump of some radioactive substance and it has, a half-life of 10 seconds that you calculate from the theory, someone else comes along and says, I think the half-life is 10 years, that person is kind of wrong. So there's a corresponding statement about the probability. If a person comes along and says, I think it has a certain probability of decaying, it has a 50% chance of decaying after 1,000 years, that person, it would seem, is objectively wrong. There's something about the world that makes it true that the half-life is 10 seconds. This is how David Wallace argues. Other people, incidentally, would argue in a different way. Chris Fuchs, in particular, argues that probabilities are all subjective. Okay, so So then there must be something in the theory. If you believe that probabilities in quantum theory, there's something objective about the probabilities you calculate in quantum theory, then there must be something in the theory that they correspond to. And in particular, we want to show that that thing is alpha squared, is the amplitude squared. And then I mentioned this principle called the principle, that if you know what the objective probability is for something, then you are rationally compelled to use that as your subjective probability. Okay. So, so here is how the proof works. So incidentally, if you want to watch this, so there's a talk on PERSA by David Wallace. And you can watch that talk. He gives these arguments more carefully than I will. So he has a set of axioms that apply to decision theoretic matters in the context of the branching structure that I drew yesterday. He uses them to prove two things. First of all, he proves that if two events have the same weight, in terms of the amplitude squared, then agents are required to give them the same probabilities. If two events. Once he has that result, then it's relatively easy to bootstrap this up into proving that, in general, the probability is given by the amplitude squared. He calls this rule here the equivalence rule.
Is the probability the subjective one?
Yeah. So the probability is the subjective one in the sense that in making decisions he has to give them the same amplitude. But the great thing is now he's managed to associate it with an objective property of the according to the many worlds interpretation, the amplitude is an objective property of the world. So he's managed to associate an agent's decision theoretic probabilities, which are subjective, with an objective property of the world. I'll show you very briefly how it works. I mean, so given this, then you can use this to prove the probabilities are in general given by amplitude squared. Okay. Yes. Okay. So I'm just going to sketch this idea, and I'm going to give a simplified version that he gave in that talk. He also gives a more sophisticated version in that talk. And the paper itself has a lot more stuff in it, which there's lots of assumptions that have to go into this, which I'm not going to spend time clarifying at this stage. I just want to give you an idea of how it works. So imagine we have so what we want to do now is prove point number one, that if two events have the same amplitude squared, they have the same probability. So imagine we're going to bet on the outcome of a spin Z measurement on a system which is prepared in this state. We could imagine betting on getting spin up. If we get spin up, we get paid $10 or a dollar, say, let's say. And if we get spin down, we get paid nothing. So if we bet on up, the situation is that the this can be the agent as well. The state becomes alpha plus times the agent getting some money plus beta spin down and the agent gets no money. And if we bet on down, then the state goes to if it comes up, then we get no money. If it comes down, we get whatever amount of money it is, $1, let's say. Now we're going to add an extra step here. You see, after the agent has his money, he doesn't really care about the system that he made a bet on. So we can imagine applying a controlled unit tree so that that system just goes into some junk state. So it could be any state, it doesn't matter. So this is a unitary transformation that looks at what's happening here and then applies a controlled unitary transformation on the particle coming in and just sends it to some junk state. Like I said, this is the simplified version of the argument. There's a different argument, just a slightly more careful version where there's an I and J here. Because then you don't have to control the unit tree. You can just imagine, hitting the whatever apparatus contains the spin particle with a hammer, or throwing it into a volcano or something. But we're just going to take the simplified version for the moment. And then likewise over here, we can also imagine a unit tree transformation, a different one. Which sends the state to this. Okay. So we've arranged things so that actually the state afterwards is the same except for the alphas and betas. If alpha equals beta, then we actually have the same state in the two cases afterwards. And so then Wallace argues that. Yeah, the same junk, yeah. This, like I said, this is a simplified version of the argument. You can give a more sophisticated version where it isn't like this.
The whole purpose of the unit tree is to make the same.
Yeah, yeah. In this case, the purpose of the unit tree is to make the same, yeah, to make the same states, as long as alpha and beta are equal. So if alpha equals beta, then we have the same state. And so we're in the same situation. So that implies that a bet on the up case should have the same decision theoretic probability as a bet on the down case. So that that proves his equivalence rule under slightly simplified conditions where I allow these controlled unit trees and they're different in each case. There's a weakness there, and he has a more careful argument where he doesn't have that same weakness. So once you've got this, once you've got the first case, then you can imagine using this. So imagine if you had a situation where you had, you know, the probability was 2 in front of one of the states. Sorry, the amplitude was 2 in front of one of the states and 1 in front of the other with some appropriate normalization. What is that, 5, I suppose? Yeah. Then you could have a process where you evolve this unitarily so it splits into two pieces. So there would exist a process that you have to entangle it with some other system. I'm not going to fill out the details. So there'll be a way of splitting this up. Well, let me do that. There'll be a way of evolving this so you end up getting 3 terms which have equal amplitude. And now we know that each of those terms since to have equal amplitude, has to have the same probability associated with it. So you end up being able to get the probabilities for more general situations where the amplitudes aren't all equal. So again, you'll find this in the papers. But the main substantive part of the argument is the first step, where you show that 2 events having the same amplitude have the same probabilities. Okay.
In this argument, we use a unit tree transformation to make 2 states seems equal. Like it means that those initial 2 states are unitary equivalent. And it's like, can we?
But no, don't forget, this is a different unit tree transformation, and that's a weakness in this simplified version. Because this controlled operation is different from this one.
When alpha and beta are equal, like how can we say that like we are betting to the same thing? Like we actually introduce some extra step that control.
Right. Yeah. And this, like I said, this is a weakness. If you look at the full argument, he would claim it doesn't have this weakness. I'm just trying to fit it into the lecture. But I recommend if you're interested, you look at that lecture up there. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is discuss some of the criticisms of the many worlds. Well, firstly, I sketched an argument due to Wallace to show that you can get probabilities coming out of this. I think it's a very noble attempt. And in fact, it even does things that are kind of surprising, because in the basic axioms of the many worlds approach that I gave you yesterday, there are no probabilities. And so probabilities end up being an effective, an emergent structure at the level of, you know, having agents and macroscopic objects that simply are not there at the fundamental level. I mean, sure, you have amplitudes, but those amplitudes are playing a different role. And the interpretation of those amplitudes as corresponding to probabilities only becomes relevant when you go to this sort of macroscopic effective level where you have agents. They're not fundamentally probabilities as such. So that's very interesting, because probabilities is a very difficult subject in philosophy of generally speaking. And if you could really show that there's an appropriate emergent notion of probability without it having to be there fundamentally, then that would be an important step forward. The jury seems to still be out. Certainly, the debates that happened here several years ago at the 50 years since Everett conference, there were many different points of view, and many people criticized these arguments. I mean, suddenly, David Wallace has to make lots of assumptions to get these results. So any one of those assumptions could be wrong. And it may be one can have reasonable alternatives in which those assumptions are wrong. So various people, criticized the argument. He even picked holes in it. So included people like Adrian Kent. David Albert, Hugh Price, and in the end, the basic problem is, well, why choose this measure rather than some other measure? You can always find ways. Certainly, if you avoid some of the axioms that David Wallace is making in the background, to have a different measure. For example, Hugh Price. Has a way to treat all descendants equally. So if you're at a certain point in this branching structure and you see ahead of you, according to the calculation, that you have, you know, seven different descendants, possible descendants, as you go along the branching structure, then you would give them each equal probability, even if the amplitudes would be different.
Then how can like prices be written consistently with Bohm slope?
Well, I mean, so what is it with what? So the Bohm, well, it isn't. That's the point. The point is to show, of these criticisms, the point is to show that the many worlds approach with the basic axioms I told you needn't necessarily give you the Bohm rule. So this is meant to be a criticism of the whole many worlds program. And if you can't show that you get the Bohm rule from those axioms, then you haven't shown that the many worlds interpretation is a viable option. So, yeah, so this is, and this is probably the most serious criticism of the whole program. If you haven't really shown that you get probabilities according to the Bohm rule, then you haven't shown that the approach works. Yeah, and there's a lot of papers on this, and like I said yesterday, I'm certainly not an expert.
Is that a matter which loophole do people pick up?
I don't know which loophole is picked up in this argument by Price. I'd have to look at all these people spoke at the conference was here in 2007. But I mean, one way to say this is, you know, David Wallace can have his very careful argument, and Price can say, I don't care. I'm going to by fiat say the weight is equal over all my descendants. Okay, and there's not much you can do about that. I mean, you can say it doesn't make sense, but if I just decide that's what I'm going to do, then David Wallace himself would have a response to this. Even if you look at his talk from 2005, he has an argument that this approach is sort of incoherent. Anyway, this is an area of active debate. And I can't do much more than tell you that there are these kinds of disagreements out there. Okay. So the second criticism, the second criticism is not really a rational criticism as such, I'll discuss this and then we can talk about it afterwards. And this is the problem, that it's distasteful. Pretty much everything you can imagine really happens. And you know, I can imagine a lot of really horrible things. And there's for these things, there is some non-zero, you know, pretty much everything has a non-zero amplitude. You know, atoms can tunnel, all sorts of horrible things could happen in this room very quickly right now. And you may think they are already, anyway. But in many worlds interpretation, all those things that have non-zero amplitude actually happen. Not that they might happen, but they actually do happen. There's very few things, if you do a full quantum field theoretic treatment, that have zero amplitude. I was discussing the many worlds approach with my wife just before we were about to sort of dig into a nice steak meal, and she asked me to stop because it was putting her off her food. And if you really have a sort of a visceral understanding of what's happening here, then it seems to me that that's the most natural reaction. If you compare this with a situation where you have a kind of stochastic ontological model, where all these different things, where only one thing happens, So things that have very small amplitudes would presumably have very small probabilities of happening and most likely wouldn't happen. Then you can have a sense that you sort of you get away with it. You know, you can imagine all the horrible things that might happen, but for the most part, they don't happen, and you kind of get away with it. You know, I was driving my car once. I was going too fast. It was rainy. It was in France. I had the tire at the back blew out, and the car was swerving. I just about managed to pull over, and I was safe. But it occurred to me at that point that in the many worlds interpretation, there were probably many branches where I didn't get away with it, you know, that would have been terrible. You know, not for me, I'd be dead, but for anyone who actually cared remotely about me. But in a stochastic model, I got away with it. You know, I was lucky, I survived. I think it's worth thinking about this kind of issue, because it's good to really understand what it is you're believing. If you believe the many worlds interpretation, you're believing something like this. From a sort of moral point of view, you know, isolation from some horrible thing is no reason not to be horrified by it. You know, just like right now, there are places in the world where terrible things are happening and we're relatively isolated from them, but morally we shouldn't be any less horrified by them than stuff that happens, right here in this room. I'm just trying to bring home what's really being believed here. This isn't really a rational objection. As such. But if you had any doubt, you know, about believing in this approach, then certainly there are reasons why you might not want to. The people who are proponents of the many worlds interpretation would say, well, you know, we've had many times in history where sort of you know, a sort of cozy point of view on reality has had to be overturned. And you know, the example they often give is before Copernicus, people believed that the Earth was the center of the cosmos, and that's somehow a very cozy point of view, that here we are, you know, people, they believed sitting at the center of the universe with the rest of the universe around them, and somehow it was quite objectionable to suddenly be projected into a, you know, sort of side story, not really the main thing the universe is about. And so that was that, which is, you know, nowadays everyone believes, where very few people believe that the Earth is the center of the cosmos. So there was an example where we had to give up a cozy point of view because science kind of forced it. And proponents of the many worlds would say, many worlds interpretation would say the same thing is happening here. Science forces us. Interference forces us to believe that there's you have this splitting, and that's just the way it is. The third criticism that it's that this the many worlds interpretation is possibly unstable to progress in physics. So, you know, I'd said before that it may be that trying to interpret quantum theory is just an academic exercise because, you know, ultimately we will have another theory, and probably, you know, quantum theory will turn out to be, you know, some limiting case, not terribly relevant case when it comes to the interpretation, and there are suddenly reasons to believe that in a theory of quantum gravity, you can't really have unitarity. I'll talk about that if I get time today. So if when we go to a theory of quantum gravity, we no longer have unitarity, then the particular feature of quantum theory upon which the many worlds approach sort of inherits its weirdness, namely that a quantum state has all these superposition in many different macroscopic terms. If that goes away in a theory of quantum gravity, then we don't have to worry about this. It's just not the right theory. Okay. And one could think of more arguments. You know, one could question whether this decoherence argument I gave yesterday really gives you the branching structure. One could say, well, perhaps the wave function should be interpreted epistemically. It should be thought of as a sort of compendium of probabilities rather than as an ontic object in itself. You know, or perhaps the next physical theory will be very different. It won't have wave functions in it at all. It'll be as different from quantum theory as general relativity was from Newtonian physics. So certainly it seems quite probable that when we move to the next fundamental physical theory, the very feature of quantum theory upon which many worlds is based will go away. Certainly, that's a possibility.
Why do quantum gravity seem to be like non-unitary?
So I'll talk about that shortly. I'm going to start talking about collapse models next, and so I'll give you some reasons for that.
But in case of first criticism, like most of the conditions can also be criticized.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Even the global model is using the unitary evolution wave function.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, like I said at the beginning, my attitude is that whilst it's interesting to study those different interpretations, probably none of them are going to be true because we're going to make some real substantial progress in physics at some point, and that will be the place where we should interpret physics. And of course, we never necessarily get to the final theory. You know, there's no stage in there's likely to be no stage at which people are certain they've got the final theory. But there are particular problems with quantum theory, you know, particular reasons that make you think it might be an interim theory, that something, that there are some fundamental issues there. Okay, any more questions on many worlds before I move on to the collapse models? No. Okay. I think collapse models won't put you off your lunch as much as many worlds. Okay.
What is mentally the good picture to understand, like, the attitude of the many worlds? I mean, like, are we considering the, like, kind of overlap of many different worlds in the same universe, like many different cases are overlapping?
Oh, what's the physical picture?
How should I imagine, like,
in some sense, all this, the wave function is just living in you know, in configuration space, it's living in one universe. So it's really just a one universe picture, but there's many different points of view because we ourselves are immersed in that, in the structure there. So these many worlds are really emergent worlds because of our perspective on the world. So one perhaps could call it many, many perspectives point of view, because there are many different branches, and we are forced to be in those branches because we're made out of the stuff that the wave function describes. So there's not some fundamental, from this point of view, there's not some fundamental split, and the whole universe doesn't split into two copies every time. You know, a superposition is created, but it's rather some effective level of description. Okay, let me move on to collapse models. So the various people who've worked on this, so Philip Pohl did the first work on this, Girardi, Rimini, and Weber, and then other people have worked on it as well. Actually, the version that we're going to look at, the particular model we'll look at, is due to John Pell. But it's a sort of reinterpretation of the GRW model. So the motivation here is to solve the measurement problem by explicitly modifying the Schrödinger equation. I should call it the reality problem. And the idea is that you modify the Schrödinger equation in such a way that small objects, like electrons, atoms, are hardly influenced at all by the modification. So we still see interference and other typical quantum phenomena. Whereas large objects are strongly influenced by the modification. In such a way that if you have things like pointer states or cats that are dead and alive, that they collapse into one or the other of the possibilities. The theories, the models that are out there are kind of ad hoc. People have just tried to invent models that do this job, leave small objects relatively unchanged, and strongly modify the behavior for strong objects, for sort of large objects. But there is a possible physical motivation for this idea coming from quantum gravity. And this has been put forward by Diossi and Penrose in slightly different forms. So I'll give the argument as I learned it from Penrose. So imagine you have some massive object, like a pointer or a ball or something like that, some relatively macroscopic object. A grain of sand would also suffice. And you're able to put it somehow by entangling it with a quantum particle, perhaps, that's in a superposition. You're able to put it so that it goes into a superposition of being in two different places. Okay. Now, since this is a massive object, it will affect the metric fields. According to general relativity, it would affect the metric fields. So you'll have some metric field over here as a consequence of the ball being in this position. And then you'll have, use a clearly different color. It's not very clear, is it? Red. You have some metric field as well, corresponding to the ball being here. So over all space, the metric fields will be modified in different ways in each of these two superimposed terms. Here I'm just talking in a loose sense. We don't actually have a physical theory of quantum gravity, but we're just imagining what it might be like. So we'll have, corresponding to this position, one geometry. And over here, we'll have another geometry.
Assuming that the metric field is in a position now. Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of the question that we're going to get to. So if this thing is in a superposition, it would seem that now you have a superposition of two metric fields entangled with the ball, the positions of the ball. Now, there's a problem, though, because this field is a function of x. Living on some, this is a point on a manifold, and likewise this one is. And you'd like to be able to say that if you consider a certain point here, you'd like to be able to say, well, if you're in this solution, this is a given x over here, and if you're in this solution, this is the same x over here. You'd like to be able to identify positions on these two manifolds between these two different solutions. But you can't do that in general relativity. There's no sense in which we have two different solutions. There's no sense in which you can identify points between those solutions. There's something called diffeomorphism invariance. Did you discuss that in the GR course? So general relativity is invariant into diffeomorphisms. What that means is that the position itself actually has no meaning, has no intrinsic meaning. The only meaning you have The only physically real quantities in general relativity are things you can construct from the fields themselves. The positions themselves have no intrinsic meaning. So there's not really any way you can identify points in this solution with points in this solution. So Penrose argues that there's just you get this kind of breakdown of physics, because you can't make sense of a superposition of two geometries. And so he says, well, something's got to give. I don't think he uses exactly that word. I don't imagine Penrose would ever say got to. But something's got to give. And he says the thing that has to give is that you can't maintain this superposition, so you have to have collapse. So this is just a heuristic argument. It's not actually a theory. It's just a motivation for saying that you shouldn't have, in quantum theory, superpositions of different geometries. And in particular, one reason you would want to be able to one reason you'd want to be able to identify points in these two geometries is because you'll want to evolve this state in time. So you need to have a notion of time that applies to both terms of this in this superposition so that you can evolve the state forward according to the Schrodinger equation. But that doesn't really make sense because of diffeomorphism invariance.
I'm trying to understand how diffeomorphism invariance is related to the superposition of the geometry.
The problem is if you want to identify points in this solution with points in this one, you want to identify space-time points, then you can't. There's no natural way of doing that.
How's that related to?
Well, because at this stage, if you believe that this thing is entangled with the geometry, then you have a superposition of two geometries, and you want to evolve that thing forward in time. But to evolve it forward in time, you need a time parameter that applies to both of those things separately. So you kind of can't. You can't. There's something that an object like this. Ball in position one and geometry one, let's call it, plus ball in position two, geometry two. This superposition, if you want to now evolve this thing forward in time, then you have a problem. But this is Penrose's argument, because you can't really pick out time parameters in these geometries.
Why not evolve balls in the geometry one and ball two in geometry separately?
The Schrodinger evolution is supposed to apply to this thing globally. So you're supposed to have hit this with some Hamiltonian that evolves them both, and it needs to talk to them both in some compatible way. So this has got to identify. There's got to be some identification between these two things so that you're hitting it with the same thing. It sort of. Anyway, this is Penrose's argument. And he claims that means you've got to have wave function collapse. And he does a bit more than that. He also suggests a time scale. And so the time scale for this collapse to happen is given by h bar divided by some energy that's associated with having this ball in two different places. And he gives an expression for that, which I'll give you. So rho and rho prime are the two density functions, the mass density functions, for the ball being in one position or the other. So this is an expression.
What is rho?
Rho is the mass density of the ball. So it'd be obviously very high where the ball is and low elsewhere. A more typical situation would be the ball is only slightly displaced and it's still overlapping. And if you integrate this out, you get some expression. Okay. Let's see. Right, so what I'm going to do next, and I won't start that today. So tomorrow I'll give you an explicit collapse model to show how you can actually find a model which has exactly the effects required, that for small objects it hardly influences them at all, and for large objects you get you get this collapse. So you solve the measurement problem in that way. Okay.
So there's been progress in putting larger and larger things in the position.
Right.
Do you know how close we are based on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the current state of play is.
They managed to put a virus in
it. Right. Yeah. I mean, of course, every time you do that, you never get 100% visibility on your thing, on your so
Yeah.
I mean, the last time I looked at it, but that was a few years ago, that wasn't. There was some pressure on the parameters of the model, but not enough to really rule them out. Adrian Kent has looked at that kind of thing. Any other questions at this stage? No. Okay. So we'll carry on tomorrow.